I'm Megan Price, head of the Secretariat of the Knowledge Platform, Security and Rule of Law. You're listening to Fragile Truths. This podcast series arranges conversations with researchers and practitioners and questions some of the fundamental assumptions underpinning current security and rule of law policies. The interviews are carried out by the policy officers who are responsible for pursuing those policies. The research teams featured in these series were part of the Security and Rule of Law Research Program of NVO VOTRO, Science for Global Development, and funded by the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In this podcast, we are setting up conversations that take a hard look at some of the ideas and assumptions driving current security and rule of law policy, and as we find out, what is often assumed as a fact or a solid truth can sometimes crack under scrutiny. This podcast is about recognizing when those policy foundations, those truths, may be fragile. At the Knowledge Platform Security and Rule of Law, one of our key objectives is to facilitate conversations at the interface of research, policy, and implementation. We find that it is exactly at this crux that certain assumptions about what factors contribute to or undermine peace and security can be drawn out and tested. Today's conversation provides an example of why this intersection of perspectives is so crucial for strengthening the security and rule of law sector. Today we hear a conversation among three experts, each representing one of these three professional sectors. The discussion is led by Asma Hashi, a policy officer on human security from the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Department for Stabilization and Humanitarian Aid. Asma speaks with Anna Schmouder, a research fellow from the Klingendal Conflict Research Unit, and Volkert Dope from VNG International, representing the program implementer perspective. Together, they discuss the outcomes of a research project that Anna and Volkert contributed to, focused on the role of traditional authorities in different governance structures in the Sahel. And I think this conversation is really illuminating on a number of levels. In the discussion, we hear how the international strategies for peacebuilding, security, and justice may be rendered irrelevant or ineffective if they are not well attuned to the actual governance structures upon which people rely. In one way, the concept of inclusiveness upheld by the international community may itself be a stumbling block for including these key actors. And while Anna and Volkert raise quite a number of difficult issues to wrestle with, they also set out some concrete suggestions for how to improve upon current practice and policy. It would be too easy to say the key takeaway here is a deeper appreciation for the complexity of engaging with extremely context-specific dynamics. That is something anyone listening to this podcast is likely to already be all too familiar with. Rather, what I was able to come away with was a recalibration of my own assumptions about how security and rule of law may work in practice. With that, here's the conversation between Asma, Anna, and Volkert.
Hi, Anna and Volkert. Thank you for joining us today to tell us more about your research on traditional security and governance authorities. Would you maybe like to tell us something more about yourself and about your position and what you do? And then maybe I'll start with Anna and then Volkert, we can move on to you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Asma, for the invitation. So my name is Anna Schmouder and I work as a junior researcher with Klingendal Institute, the Netherlands Institute for International Relations. And here I focus on working in the Sahel, mostly on hybrid governance. So that means the intersection between formal authorities, traditional authorities, and then also the governance provided by armed groups in the region.
Yeah, Asma, so thank you so much for hosting this. And it's so interesting to be on this podcast. So I'm Volker Doop. I'm a program manager with VNG International. So we are the development agency of the Association of Dutch Municipalities. And I work on projects largely focused on local security, specifically in the Great Lakes region, but also in the Sahel. Earlier, I also worked for IOM in Niger, so that gives me also some background in the region.
Fantastic. Thank you for introducing yourselves. Would you like to tell us a bit more about the research and where you started when conducting the research? So maybe start with the research questions and what the aim was of the research.
What our research was trying to analyze is the role that traditional leaders, traditional authorities take in the governance, especially in fragile settings. So we have long known that traditional authorities play a role, but that role has not really been analyzed, especially since the onset of violent conflict in Mali since 2012-13. So we were not only interested in the role they take, especially in the border region between Mali and Niger, but similarly how they are impacted in their role by the armed groups that we've seen emerge. So that was the main goal. And like I said, we focused on a border region in Mali in the north, so in Meneka and Gao, and then in Niger in the Tillaberi and Tahoua regions.
Yeah, and I think also something that we were really interested in is why the conflict in the area has manifested itself so differently in at the two sides of the borders. So you have populations which are quite similar in background, but the state is quite different. And also traditional leaders at both sides of the border. But you really see at the Malian side where there are armed groups, and the traditional leaders have taken a very different role there than at the Nigerian side of the border.
That's very interesting. Maybe you can tell us in a bit, Volkert, on the different roles the traditional authorities have taken. But maybe it's also interesting first to understand what you mean with traditional when you talk about these authorities. So what distinguishes them from non-traditional authorities in your view?
Well, traditional is actually opposed to the state, and that is very interesting, because in Niger, for example, the traditional authorities were not so only traditional, but were actually a result also of colonial policies, and as such they were integrated into the state. Mali had a similar history, but they broke with that in the post-colonial era. And so I think what is very interesting is that the traditional authorities, they get their legitimacy from their community, but either or not, they receive the power from the state. So on the Nigerian side of the border, traditional authorities would get a role in community governance, whereas on the Malian side, they didn't.
Yeah, and just to add to what Volker just said, so traditional authorities is actually derived from custom. So where people obey a certain person or office, and it can be tribal leaders or, for example, a village chief or a district chief, because it has always been that way, right? And so when we look at traditional authority figures in Mali, in Niger, that custom and tradition can actually be highly localized and vary according to each region and to each village and locality. And so we also, if we speak about traditional leaders, we also speak about customary leaders and traditional authorities, and all these terms are actually interchangeable.
Great. Thank you for answering that question and clarifying a bit on what traditional means as opposed to what maybe we're used to. Could you maybe take us back to the research question and what the main question was for this research?
Yeah, sure. So the main research question was, how do traditional authorities engage in local governance in the fragile settings that we find in the Malian-Nigerian border area? And what then are the consequences for national interventions aiming to foster local governance and stability in the region?
Volkert, could you maybe tell us a bit more about conducting the research and how you went about that?
Yeah, it's nice that you asked this question, because actually I'm not a researcher. I work for an implementing organization. We do different projects for different donor organizations as well. And so actually what was very interesting is for us to partner up really in a project, really working together with researchers, because that brought together the information and sort of way that we work as an implementing organization. I think it was really feeding into the research questions. And also, of course, we didn't know at the beginning how the research would go. So, of course, the research questions were developing over time. But also we saw that there was a third country which we were less involved, but it was in Libya. And we saw a strong deterioration of the security situation there. It was a project which was conducted, a research, in a relatively short amount of time. So also there, the planning had to shift. And we worked with local partners, because obviously we wanted to get the data from all these localities. And so we were dependent also on when the researchers would be able to travel to those areas and gather the data. We planned a number of workshops throughout the research period, one at the beginning, one during the research, and one at the end. it's sort of and to analyze the data. And that that was very interesting. And for me, it was very interesting as an implementing organization to see also how researchers work in that sense. But perhaps, Anna, you can also say a bit what you felt about the collaboration with different types of organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I think this podcast is actually exemplary for, you know, breaking out of the silos that we all usually operate in. So here we have policymaking, implementation research, and that was actually one of the key points for me in this project, that it was the first time that we got to work together, implementing organization with VNGI and then a research organization as Klingendahl on one research question. And there are a lot of lessons learned, but maybe we can talk about them a bit later. And I just want to come back to one of the challenges that is obviously always the case when we do data collection in such, you know, fragile settings as in the Sahel. For us as research organizations is just the fact that for security reasons, we can rarely leave the designated safe zones, right? And so in Mali, that's the capital, Bamako, and which is why we also relate heavily on local research organizations, on national researchers that actually have detailed knowledge. So in Niger, for example, we work with EPCA, with Rahman Idrissa, who is a researcher at the University of Leiden. That's part and parcel of our research, actually. And then maybe just coming back to an anecdote that was for me very exemplary of our key finding, which is the major difference that traditional authorities hold in the governance system in Mali and then in Niger. And I still remember just having arrived from Bamako in Niamey. And I think, Volker, we went to a ministry and had an interview there. And when we stepped out, we saw this car of a regional traditional chief, and on the number plate, he was designated as the car of the chief. And I still remember how astonished I was, because this is like completely unthinkable in Mali, where you do not have this formal recognition of traditional authorities at such a high level. So whenever now I think back of, you know, the differences, and we obviously continue to work on traditional authorities and the hybridity of governance in Mali and Niger, this is always the first picture that comes to my mind.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I want to go back and touch upon your collaboration and cooperation with local organizations. From a policy perspective, it is also becoming increasingly important for us to engage more with local partners in the countries that we work in and in which our programs are being implemented. And of course, as you said, Mali, Niger, and Libya as well are conflict-affected countries or post-conflict countries. And the importance of working in a conflict-sensitive manner, or at least making sure that the intervention does not exacerbate the security situation, is therefore very important. How did you go about that during your research when, for example, selecting the partners that you were working with or the local researchers that you were cooperating with?
Yeah, it's a really important question. Usually it's already in the selection of municipalities that we do data collection that national partners are involved, because they would know best, you know, where they have access and where the security situation allows. But we also obviously monitor security situation along the data collection. So in the case of this project, the status quo defined that data collection took place in March to May 2019. And you need to do that continuously during the data collection to know where researchers can actually travel. And at the same time, of course, if you work with researchers that are from a certain region where you would like to do data collection, that also has its advantages, because they can ask entirely different questions than a researcher that might come from a very different region or just outside.
Yeah, and I think, whereas Klingendahl and EPCA had a lot of experience of identifying the correct researchers we're doing to work. Like, we are at VNG, for example, we are not researchers, but what we do know is how to engage with authorities and also try and identify ways how we can take a problem and translate it into a practical solution and sort of build also a coalition around those solutions. And engaging with the different stakeholders, having those conversations, Anna, you already mentioned, we passed that, I think that was at the Ministry of Interior Later on, we visited also the Ministry of Justice. So that was really on the national level, and sort of also link that then to the findings we found on the terrain. And if you read our research report, like, we identify a lot of local brokers who can help contain or mitigate some of the violent conflict that we're seeing in the border regions. So developing ideas around the stakeholders we engage with, I think that was very interesting to do, and to do that with the in-depth information that we got from the field and the interpretation by the researchers.
I would like to move on to the lessons learned from the research then. Could maybe one of you highlight some of the most important lessons?
Let me start, and then Volker, feel free to jump in. So I think, you know, what was revealed was really the somewhat overlooked role that traditional authorities play in the governance systems of both Mali and Niger. And especially if you take the long-term look, also the politicization to which they have been subject to since the democratization in the early 1990s. But then particularly in areas of limited state presence, so the Mali-Niger border area on which we focus, traditional authorities are actually key governance actors, and they engage, you know, both in local conflict resolution and mitigation, which in turn then provides them a high degree of legitimacy and trust among local communities. But then at the same time, we've seen that armed groups in these regions have shown an astute awareness of the need to really strategically engage with these religious and traditional leaders. And they also seek to actively undermine traditional authorities. And so I guess if anything, this illustrates how traditional authorities in Mali and Niger are actually entry points to rural communities, both for the state, if they wish to engage on local conflict resolution, local peace building, local governance, but also for armed actors such as, you know, self-defense militias, but also, of course, extremist groups.
Volkert, would you maybe like to add to that?
One of the things is, in many countries, we work on the social contract. And this really, for me, many of the findings that we got out of the research boiled down to questions around the social contract and how does it affect local security. As I said earlier, like, we had many players in the field which have been there for decades, if not longer, which would be able to mitigate contracts. And at some point in the research, we talk about the Ruga and the Garso, which are the traditional scouts, for example, which go ahead of the herders to look for good pasture, but also to avoid any clashes with other groups in the vicinity. A question really could be, like, how do we scale up, or how do we allow these Ruga and Garso to do their work? Under which conditions are they able to do their work? The macro lens, when you look at this area, and we live in an era of desertification, climate change, when there is a scarcity of water, enormous population growth, livestock is growing. So under which conditions are these people able to do their work? Another example is, for example, the distribution of arms and weapons in that region. That has exacerbated enormously the conflict. And perhaps in the past there was also conflict, but now with a lot of arms in circulation. Well, traditional authorities have their ways to reach out to the community to help disarm their communities. And I think we can really learn how to put that into one narrative around the social contract. What is the role of the state? What is the role of the traditional authority? And what is the role of the community that they can play in assuring local stability?
Yeah, and to add to what Volker just said, you know, specifically with the role of the Ruga and Garso, for example, that's just illustrative of the fact that policymakers and implementers working on governance or peace building in the Sahel, they essentially have to deal with plurality of governance actors, so with varying degrees of formality. And those governance actors are not necessarily complementary, but they can also even be in competition, right? And so this is what we, from a research angle, would call then a hybrid political order in the Sahel that is actually very challenging if you want to engage in implementation and really make an effort and a change. And so I think one other, you know, bit broader finding of the research is really that if you want to engage in efforts such as broadest local governance, peace building, conflict resolution, they all will remain incomplete if they fail to comprehend and include the crucial role of customary traditional governance actors that are entry points to rural communities. And looking a bit at the European level, you know, in the past year, and especially with the, say, since the Malian coup, the military coup that took place in August last year, there's been this renewed focus and almost like a mantra on governance as the central pillar for stabilization and peace building in the Sahel. And I would say, while that is true, then the next step would be to go even further and see how, like, what can we learn from this hybridity, this multiplicity of governance in the Sahel. And
so what are some practical lessons that you've learned when reflecting on this?
Yeah, I would say there are at least three major points. So the first is the recognition that, you know, the focus on former state actors alone is actually not sufficient, because you can not see the full picture. You miss half of it. The second, what is needed for each project implementation is actually a political economy analysis, where you get a clear view on the roles and positions of each actors. So for example, if you're working on engaging youth in local governance, in the access to natural resources and conflicts surrounding that, you would need to engage customary leaders as well, because they play a crucial role, especially in the access to natural resources. And then the third point, I think, is that you definitely need adaptive programming, meaning that rather than having this static project logs, frames, you need to be able to change indicators of progress, you know, during the duration of a implemented project, adapt them to the developments around you.
Yeah, I fully agree with what Anna just said, and especially, and that I found so interesting is, basically we were already engaging in political economy analysis. And for us as implementing organizations, it's so important to have interlocutors at all the different levels. Like, we are an organization which focuses on local governance and on local security. But that doesn't mean that we should only work at the local level, but we also need the buy-in at the national level. And this project also allowed us to interact with those national actors, maybe to jump back a bit back to the beginning of this conversation, but when Anna was talking about customary chiefs being based on customary law, which de facto means like unwritten law. So it's very difficult to go back and look at the law. So at the national level, there was at some point the movement to codify customary law. Well, there is a lot of vested interests, of course. And it means really also being in there for the long haul to affect that change. So, yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
That's definitely an important aspect, I think, to keep in mind when working with local or community leaders, that not all of the laws, as we are maybe used to, are written and available for everyone to just access. I briefly want to touch upon something that you mentioned, Anna, about the importance of working with community leaders when, for example, engaging with youth. Inclusive governance from the policy perspective is very important, and making sure that all the wishes and needs of community members are represented by their authority members. To what extent do community leaders or traditional security or governance structures represent their communities in this way? For example, also looking at youth, which you mentioned, or women.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think it's one of the challenges that we see from implementers and policy perspective, that we often find traditional authorities have, especially compared to state authorities and in rural areas, a very high legitimacy across all sections of the population. They are perceived as trustful, highly trustful, but at the same time, their mode of governance is not necessarily an inclusive one, right? And it actually depends from locality to locality, but they are also part of a hierarchical structure. So many positions of traditional authority are actually hereditary. So you have the position for the rest of your life, and there's very little inclusion. But at the same time, what we've seen in different localities. So that's, for example, the case in northern Niger, where we've done separate research, but also in central Mali, is that there are now increasingly projects that focus on creating on a district level, so in cities, really in different quartiers and districts, to have this inclusive manner where traditional authorities are presiding over neighborhood committees, for example. But then you also have the inclusion of women leaders, of youth leaders. And then this comes back to a bit more inclusive way of making, of decision-making and governance. And I would also like to stress that the fact that you mentioned about inclusiveness of traditional authorities is, of course, highly localized, right? So we recently finished a different research project in central Mali, and there's this big distinction between traditional authorities, including youth leaders, including women leaders, when those projects are funded from external donors, somewhat feeling that this is just an inclusion pro forma. So, and I guess that that's really a challenge for the long term. I think the crucial fact is to recognize that traditional leaders are, even though they might lack an inclusivity, are there to stay, and they play this important role. So it's a matter of seeing how they can be incorporated in other existing approaches to form more inclusive governance and, yeah, including both women and youth.
Yeah, and I think there was one example which was brought up in the research, which was very interesting. It doesn't only exist in the pro forma way, but sometimes there's also like, and normally it's hereditary, and it goes the community leadership goes from father to son. But if there is in the larger family, there is a woman who can make the claim. Nigerian law doesn't specify that it needs to be a man. But if in the larger family, a woman can make a claim on the leadership of the community, they can make that claim. And there is really then also that that discussion is then within the community. There are examples of this debate really taking place inside the community. Only it is really something for the long haul. And it's indeed, as Anna was saying, like you should really avoid that you create a situation where there is a change of, or where women are much more included into the governance structure only because it is funded by an external partner. Like that's absolutely something you would want to avoid.
Thank you for clarifying that. Anna, would you maybe like to add to that?
Yeah, maybe just as a last point. I mean, it is a critical question, and we're actually also investigating that further because it links to the... I think it links to this bigger question of whether traditional authorities, despite being perceived as more legitimate than, for example, former state authorities, whether they're actually contributing to, you know, community resilience, to making community stronger, or whether they're also contributing to undermining this resilience. And that's actually a question we are currently investigating in a follow-up project to the research we did in 2019 that is funded by USAID. And we're currently wrapping up data collection in 30 selected municipalities in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Because you're definitely right that especially the exclusive side of governance provision by traditional authorities, you know, has also created a lot of grievances and fault lines that is then, as we see, being exploited by violent extremist organizations. So this is a question that we keep investigating, and I think we'll be able to publish our findings this summer.
Thank you for adding that, and I'm looking forward to maybe reading that when you publish it. Are there other missed opportunities during this research when you reflect back on it that you would like to follow up on maybe in a different research project or?
I mean, one of the main questions is, I think, what I just mentioned. So to what degree are traditional authorities actually contributing or undermining to stability? And we tend to think of them as, well, a force that is conducive to stability and local governance. But at the same time, those are still civilian actors, right? And even they might be recognized in formal administration of villages, as is the case, for example, in Mali, they're still faced with this massive lack of capacities and resources. So we have a long list of recommendations in our report, but most of them actually depend on structural reforms to take place. And we know that this is a very long-term goal. I would say that in the meantime, while we are waiting for reforms to, for example, address this parallel structures of governance, to address the question of codification of customary justice, the traditional authority structures continue to change and adapt. So we mentioned, I think, in the beginning that this is a research that took place in 2019, data collection in early 2019. We now have 2021. I'm not saying that the findings are entirely outdated. The dynamic is definitely still the same, but as we know how quickly the conflict dynamics are moving across the Sahel, yeah, this is actually a continuous quest to understand the changing role of traditional authorities in this armed conflict dynamics.
Yeah, and I think also like in 2019, I mean, we had so many discussions around this research also, and with the policymakers in Niger and Mali. And now we are 2 years later. Of course, last year was also difficult to do some of the follow up, at least from the my perspective. And very recently, we had elections in Niger also. So, and then I earlier spoke also how you need to find allies, coalitions around certain reforms. And of course, we also need to see how the incoming government in Niger looks at this issue and how they approach this issue.
So we're nearing the end of the podcast at the moment. Anna, you mentioned some recommendations that flowed out of this research. Would you be able to share some of those with us?
Happy to. I think the most basic one is really to invest in resources and capacities of local governance authorities, because we see when we look at the grievances and conflict lines that all of them actually emerge on really the micro level. And so that means we have to take them more seriously already as a preventive approach even, right? To not always be reactive to conflict, but look at a preventive method, where does it emerge? And I think here the lack of resources and capacities for traditional authorities is an important factor. And then coming back to this bigger role that I mentioned earlier on the role of traditional authorities in the contemporary governance structures, we really need to talk about constitutional reforms and structural reforms. And that's all a very long-term process, but we have actual reforms that we can talk about. For example, in Mali, in the peace agreement of 2015, there's the plan to now give traditional authorities a new role on the national level by designating seats for them in a new second chamber of parliament that remains to be created. And then the last point would be the codification of traditional authorities in, customary justice provision. So to deal with the parallel governance structures that we see that are not necessarily complementary, but actually very often in competition with each other. And that's not only true for Mali, but similarly for Burkina Faso, for example. And then in terms of implementation, I think the other point is, of course, to recognize when working on programming that you need to take all governance actors into account, and it's not sufficient to stick to formal governance actors alone. And to really include political economy analysis and the possibility for adaptive programming.
Thank you, Anna. Volkert, would you maybe like to add to that?
Yeah, I think Anna already mentioned some key things. Perhaps just the order would be different for me, because for me it was just, it was very good to be involved in this research and real recommendations, like really as an implementing organization, like and as policymakers, like we need to understand the context in which we're working. If we're trying to make a change, do that analysis, discuss, understand how the social contract is being formed in those countries. What is the role of the different entities in society? The second one would be what we're doing here right now, breaking those silos, really work together. And the third one, as Anna was also mentioning, find those coalitions across the different layers of society, also at the national level. It doesn't mean if you're talking about local security that you should only work at the local level. It also means creating the conditions for local change to actually take place. And so that would be it for me.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us today. And I agree with you, Volkert, that it was very nice to break out of our silos and to engage in some meaningful discussion. So I would like I would like to thank both of you for sharing your experiences with us. So thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You've been listening to a conversation between Anna Schmauder, researcher for the Klingendahl Conflict Research Unit, Volkert Doop, program specialist at VNG International, and Asma Hashi, Dutch foreign policy officer focused on human security. If you're curious to learn more about the research or get in touch with the researchers, you'll find links to the reports in the show notes. We'd love to know what you think of the podcast. We're trying something new and we're keen for feedback. So check out the show notes for ways to get in touch and share your thoughts. Fragile Truths is sponsored by VOTRO, Science for Global Development, and the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I'm Megan Price. Thanks for listening.